This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. At a time when the status of immigrants is in flux following executive orders from the White House, why be optimistic about the possibility of market-friendly immigration reform? Tim Kaine is an economist at the Hoover Institution. He's optimistic. We spoke yesterday. When I speak with David Beer, one of our immigration policy people here at the Cato Institute, he is, relative to last year, more optimistic about immigration reform. And perhaps that is because last year the odds were zero that it was going to happen. And this year the odds are greater than zero.
Yeah.
So why are you optimistic?
You know, there's a great reason to be optimistic about immigration reform in 2017. And the reason is Donald Trump. Even if he's not doing things that you or I or any of our listeners think are great, the fact is he's a man of action. And we've all got to be honest, the politicians in Washington, D.C. for about two decades have not wanted to be active on this. They wanted to be very political with it. It's been a hot potato. Had a debate with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren recently, and she was saying, well, you know, the executive action of Obama was great. And I said, you know, but why is it temporary? Why is the DACA and DAPA programs, they're three-year temporary legal status? And that's because, frankly, the president, Obama, wanted those issues to be political hot potatoes. I think you've got a president now in the White House who wants to solve things. Now, I'll push back where I think he's solving them in the wrong way. But he says there won't be action on other immigration areas until we build a wall, until we have security, and he's going to build a wall. And it'll be really fun, Caleb, to have that conversation in 2019 of was it effective or not? Because frankly, that's where it's been, you know, Lucy in the football, like right with Charlie Brown. Yep, the border's never secure. I think we're going to be able to say, hey, look, you built the wall, the border's secure. Now let's deal with the 11 million illegal immigrants. Now let's create a work visa program that responds to market forces. I'm extremely optimistic.
See, my suspicion is that you build the wall and that just shifts the discussion from why didn't the wall work and what else do we need to do? I don't think it moves the discussion toward substantial positive reform that serves employers, that serves people who want to come here and work, and serves the job creation in the U.S.
That's a fair point. I think I'd like to frame the conversation and start engaging the administration with, I think it is going to work, right? I think it is going to restrict the flow. And the dirty secret of people that look at immigration reform is that the number of illegal immigrants has been steady at 11 million. Now, that may be because my theory, the supply of migrants from Latin America has gone down. You see the decline in birth rates of women in El Salvador or Honduras compared to 1950 to today. It's gone from about seven children per woman in each of these countries to about two or two and a half children per woman. Now, there's a lag effect of about 20 years when they become adults. Do they go north looking for work? And we've seen that flow go down. There is a refugee flow coming out of the triangle countries in Central America. But the 11 million number is pretty steady. So the real challenge is how do you regularize them? And again, another reason for optimism, comprehensive immigration reform is dead. We're going to deal with issues one at a time. And I think that paints an opportunity for centrists to come together. And these tend to be centrists who believe in market forces. So
there are, I think it's an unfortunate distinction that is drawn between workers who are here to do jobs that Americans don't really want to do or wouldn't be proud to do necessarily, and jobs that Americans would like to have but aren't qualified to do.
Hmm.
Zoe Lofgren, as you mentioned,
yeah,
she would like to increase the minimum salary associated with H-1B visa workers. It has been $60,000. She would like to raise that to $130,000. What do you see as the impact of something like that?
I don't understand why you would want to do that, other than the classic sort of union-friendly bait and switch of let's protect workers, but actually we're declining people the opportunity to work, right? This is the argument for the minimum wage, when the minimum wage was instituted to block people from coming into the labor force and being competitive. In fact, any law that tells people they can't work, it's illegal for them to work of their own free volition, is probably a bad law. I think the way we should deal with the visa, the work visa program, is to eliminate or reduce the alphabet soup of different kinds of work visas and let different companies bid for those. And so let that determine what's needed. Because frankly, the farmers in the United States, they need farm migrant workers. The flaw right now is that it's a seasonal program. So loosen that seasonal restriction. It's just another way that we need to loosen, not raise regulations on migrant workers.
So your argument then would be don't set some arbitrary number for the dollars that you'll be paying these workers when they come here, but let companies bid for them and broaden the range of companies or groups or individuals that can bid for workers in different sectors.
Absolutely right. I think if you trust consenting adults to make the right economic decisions for themselves, those are going to be better decisions than a paternalistic government.
But the economic argument, I think if I should put words in some of these people's mouths, it would be, you know, these high-paid engineers, typically people who work on software, the number of jobs that they will be creating by coming here and doing that work will be so much higher than the number of jobs created by someone who works at a dry cleaner or runs a convenience store or does agricultural work for some time.
Yeah, there are huge complementarities even among human capital. So if you bring in a great programmer from Singapore, a kid who goes to Stanford University to study, first attitude should not be to kick him out, because the fact of is he stays in a company in the United States, he's going to help create jobs for other Americans who are native born here. The research shows that for every one high-skilled visa holder who's hired here, there's an average of 2.8 jobs created for native workers. That's a pretty big win-win. Same's true for low-skill workers. So yeah, I don't buy the research or the argument, I should say, that low-skill workers or high-skill workers are stealing jobs. They're helping create jobs.
But that distinction nonetheless exists. There are members of Congress who feel perfectly comfortable saying, well, we need to focus on these high-skilled workers where we don't have these skill sets already in existence among Americans in the United States.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm a big fan, as I said, of taking those wins. If you can get a piece of legislation through Congress where you'd have 90% of the members supporting it saying, let's expand the amount of green cards that are given to foreigners that have engineering degrees from U.S. universities. Let's get Congress working together on legislation to improve the law. And then after those coalitions are formed, and you know who are the pure restrictionists, go on to the other skill levels. And I would take that, even though I think it's half a loaf and I want the whole loaf. It's all good stuff. But take half the loaf where you've got the consensus right now.
Donald Trump doesn't seem to be interested in that kind of high-skilled immigration either.
Donald Trump has said a lot of things about a lot of things. And there was a fascinating discussion. This may have preceded his presidential ambitions, but he was in an interview and Steve Bannon was in the room, and Donald Trump was making the point that there are these good immigrants that add to the U.S. economy. And Bannon was like, well, I may disagree with you on that. And they chuckled about it. I think his instincts are actually better than some of the staff around him. But I know some of the other people that are going into the administration, good free market people. And I think there'll be some folks we can work with there. And eventually, I think the president's going to have his heart on the right side.
If I were working for, let's say, Infosys or the Tata Corporation or something like that, I might also think, well, maybe I want a lot of these engineers to stay here in India and build up our capacity to create great products and export them.
Yeah, I think there's a battle for talent, and we've been winning that battle by default. It will become in this century more and more a pressing issue as we realize there's that. And I think, unfortunately, there's already been a misstep, this freezing of visas, even among legal permanent residents that came out of the executive orders at the end of January, that's going to backfire. Because if you are a talented young superstar programmer, whether you're from India or whether you're from Germany, this creates a little cloud of suspicion that your life could be disrupted if depending on the whims of an executive order in the future. So unfortunately, I think that was a step back, but it was corrected. And hopefully it won't be repeated, because I think, you know, nobody says that one data point's a trend, but if you get two or three data points that are pretty clearly anti-immigrant and that side's winning inside the White House, it could be harmful.
Where does the United States take its refugees from?
Wow, fun question. You'd think that they all came from Syria, but in fact, very few of the It's been about 70,000 a year historically. President Obama raised it to 90 and then 110,000. Very few of those came from Syria. We've had them from all over. But let me read you some numbers that I think were just so compelling as I looked into this. We had 1,682 Syrian refugees admitted in 2015. In 2014, it was 105. 2013, it was 30-something. 2012, 31. 2011, 25. 25, 25, 24. Very few refugees, even years of civil war in Syria, came from there. They come from a number of places. And I think this may be a good time for President Trump to have changed the conversation and where should our focus be. I've long believed that we should focus on allied countries, and among those I would say are Afghanistan and Iraq, where we've got allies fighting alongside us. But maybe focus a little bit more on this hemisphere, where we have a refugee crisis in Central America, and yet very few refugees have been accepted from El Salvador, Honduras, Haiti, Nicaragua, and those countries. And we've got a role to play. We've got a humanitarian role to play. It's just up to the discretion of the president. Unfortunately, Caleb's president has been a little clumsy in the way he's dealt with it, but I think it's a good conversation to have.
What is the upside of that focus other than reassuring our friends to the extent that countries can have friends?
Well, I think America has a role to play as a role model. We've been a role model in accepting refugees from around the world. But the overall numbers are important. So at the peak, I mentioned we had 110,000 refugees coming globally. You know how many refugees there are just in Syria alone? It's the millions, more than 10 million displaced people in Syria alone. So in some sense, dealing with refugees is a salve for a guilty conscience. You help a few people, but I think trying to advance through diplomacy, through our troop deployments, trying to advance economic freedom around the world is the best way to make sure that the refugee crises don't happen in the first place.
Tim Kaine is an economist at the Hoover Institution. Subscribe to this podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.